attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Peter Weinberg. Like a B2B Batman, Peter, along with John Lombardo, was the brains behind the famously brilliant B2B Institute at LinkedIn, whose greatest miracle was being able to produce B2B marketing reports that people actually wanted to read. An evangelist for a more creative and entertaining age for B2B, they were on a mission to show how everything from a whimsical mascot to a catchy jingle has a role to play in business to business. After that, Peter disconnected himself from LinkedIn to set up Evidenza, again with John, their own AI-powered research platform that uses synthetic data to create super precise audience insights. Peter explains, "We basically took Ritson's brain and turned it into code. We had Ritson build us the ultimate platonic form of a marketing plan, and we now have a software system that can programmatically build and spit out Ritson-style marketing plans. Some fucks keep slipping in, but we're working on that." Welcome to the show, Peter.
What an introduction. Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
We worked on the Mini MBA's tone of voice guide. We had to learn how they could articulate Mark's voice without too many shits and fucks. So
yeah, it's hard. Yeah. It's a struggle with Ritson getting past all the fucks and shits. But it really adds a certain distinctiveness to the brilliant marketing advice that he has to offer.
Totally does. Right, we've got seven quickfire questions. Simon or Garfunkel?
Ooh, Simon. Does anyone ever say Garfunkel to that question?
We've never asked. They're unique to our guests.
That's great, great.
Mascot or jingle?
Mascot.
Well, I know you're a Nintendo fan. Princess Peach or Koopa Troopa?
Probably Koopa Troopa.
Good call. Right, we've got marketing versus sci-fi here. Philip Kotler or Philip K. Dick?
Definitely Philip K. Dick. Every time, twice on Sunday.
Nice. Right, artificial intelligence or real stupidity?
Yeah, I mean, based on the business I'm in, obviously I've got to go with AI. Stay on brand.
Nice. Two more. Winterfell or King's Landing?
Winterfell.
And finally, since he couldn't join us today, John Travolta or John Lombardo?
I'll take anyone over John Lombardo. It's like, it's an easy John Travolta for me, no question.
And so starts the smear campaign.
Yeah, that's just the first of many smears you'll hear against my wonderful co-founder, John Lombardo.
Amazing. Oh, brilliant. You sailed through those. Brilliant. Well, listen, Peter, thank you so much for joining us. We always start the show by asking our guests about their path to where they are now, and we find it's rarely even a linear one. So can you tell our audience, what was your first ever job, and then what was what you regard to be first proper job?
My first ever job, I'd have to think about that. You know, when I was like maybe 8 or 9, my mom told me about the stock market, and it really just captured my imagination. I was like, it sounds amazing. So she was like, yeah, you know, do you want to buy a stock? And I was like, absolutely, I do. So I think I put maybe $10 into the stock market. I think I split it. I think I put $5 on Toys R Us and $5 on the Four Seasons, two brands I thought were just great brands at the time. I believe both of them ultimately went bankrupt. Four Seasons, I think, is back. Actually, I think maybe they're both back, but suffice to say, it was not a great trade. So I guess I was a day trader. That was probably my first job.
Amazing. At 8 or 9. Wow, how to flummox it. I've got a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old at home, and I'm yet to broach that.
Well, you should tell him about the stock market. I mean, he may have some really bad stock tips for you. You could use it, you know, you could see what he wants to buy, and then you could short those things. I think it would probably be the recommendation based on my own experience.
Yeah, what an amazing intro. And then what other jobs did you have as you kind of grew up in, you know, your teenage years? Typically, people do all sorts.
Yeah, I don't think I really had many odd jobs, to be perfectly honest. I delivered newspapers at one point. My sisters would hire me to just be kind of their butler for a while. I think my first proper job was really when I got out of college and I went into advertising.
Yeah. You studied history, right? That seems to be, I mean, there's few consistencies I've spotted in the 150 plus episodes we've recorded, but it's quite remarkable how history seems to be a gateway drug for our industry.
Is that true? That's very interesting. Yeah, listen, I mean, I can't say it's been directly applicable. It's probably why I didn't have any jobs and why I had so much trouble getting a job out of college, is because I had such a useless degree. But, you know, I will say, I think John and I have always said the marketing industry has too many futurists and not enough historians. And if you actually look back on how we thought about marketing 100 years ago, in some cases, it's actually more advanced and realistic than how we think about it today. So I do think there's a great benefit to knowing the history of our industry, knowing where we've come from. And I'm sure that carries over, broadly speaking, into life. Good to know the past to understand the present and the future. I do love history. It's a great, great, great thing to study. I wouldn't say it's the most commercially valuable thing to study, but it was a good time.
Yeah, I think it's more the skills you kind of pick up when you study history. And I'm saying this, I've recorded an episode with Ali Owen recently, and I made the same point to her that I think Orlando Wood from System One and a few others who I did name check, but names escape me now, had gone from history into similar kind of strategic type roles where understanding, like from a diagnostics perspective, what had happened in the past, it could even be recent past when they were then planning, seemed to be a closer link to history than I probably originally thought.
I'm a bit of a skeptic of the value of formal education, so I wouldn't say I'm going to be here giving you the hard sell for studying history as a way of learning advertising. I think you'd probably be better off studying advertising to learn advertising. But, you know, as I said, I do think marketers especially, they're obsessed with the future, and sometimes they don't have enough respect for the past, especially of the brand, the heritage of the brand. People are very quick to kind of dismiss that, move on from it, launch new creative. So to the degree history teaches you anything, it's that you have to understand the past, you have to have respect for the past, you have to, you know, understand how the past impacts the present and the future. And I suppose history does give you all of those things.
Yeah. But I mean, I think I made the point to Mark Ritson, funny enough, we mentioned him earlier when I interviewed Mark, that I wish that at the universities, I mean, worldwide, but I was specifically talking about the universities that kind of feed our team at GASP, spent more time studying, you know, the late, great Jeremy Bullmore, amongst others, than they typically do. How did you end up in Adland then?
Well, running with the train of thought here of studying history, I, of course, could not find a job out of college. So I just applied to a very broad range of different industries. And I was very interested in advertising. And, you know, actually, it's funny. I was interested in advertising for a very particular reason, which is that at some point in college, I watched a TED Talk. And the TED Talk was from Rory Sutherland, who has one of the most watched TED Talks of all time. I think it's called Confessions of an Ad Man. And I just listened to Rory talk about advertising and how it's sort of applied psychology. And I just said to myself, like, wow, that, you know, I want to do that for a living. I want to be Rory Sutherland. I promptly applied to many jobs at Ogilvy and was promptly rejected from all of them. So it never happened. But years later, I actually got the opportunity to meet Rory. I've met him a number of times now. I've told him, depending on the day of the week, I'm either very grateful to him for getting me into the advertising industry or furious at him for ruining my life. But, you know, I think the TED Talk honestly set me down the path of being interested in advertising. And then I happened to get a job at an ad agency at Dentsu, working as like a, I don't know what it was, an assistant account executive or something like that on the Miracle-Gro account, which was very funny because I'm from New York City and I've never seen a garden or a lawn. And that was the category I was in, garden and lawn care. So I truly had no idea what I was talking about on a number of levels. The rest is history, as they say.
Amazing. I remember that talk as well. I think it had a similarly kind of pivotal impact on me. I think that first one, Confessions of an Ad Man, is that where he talks about the Eurostar example?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of his. The funny thing about Rory is every time you hear him talk, he's got a few things. The Eurostar anecdote sort of throughout. He's still talking about that today. But yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, I would highly, highly recommend to listen to it. I think he's probably the greatest spokesman for our industry. The most quotable man in the marketing industry. And, you know, I do think he makes the essential point that marketing is applied psychology. You have to understand the human brain. It's about influencing the human brain. And you need that sort of grounding in behavioral economics and psychology in order to understand what marketing effectiveness should look like. So I think Rory was very early on that idea and just continues to be. He's actually even more famous now, you know, because a bunch of people have taken, TikTok. All these kids have taken clips of him from TikTok, and now he's getting stopped in the street. And everyone's like, oh my God, you're the guy from TikTok. So Rory's bigger than ever, which is great, right?
It is great, yeah. No, Rory's a good friend of ours at Gasp. He's done loads with us over the years to support us. Huge fans. I subscribe to The Spectator just for his column.
Yeah, he's the best. He's the best. True way with words. A flower is a weed with a marketing budget, I think is one of the all-time quotes about the marketing industry.
Yeah. Taking everything you learned from that TED Talk specifically and then starting in Adland, you must have felt, well, I'm assuming you felt similarly to me, that you wish you could just play that talk to everyone in Adland because the way they were behaving suggests that they didn't really understand anything from the kind of placebo effect to everything else that might go into a perception of a brand.
Yeah, I would say the Rory talk did not necessarily give me an accurate read on what my job as an assistant account executive was going to be. But, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years later, I did get myself. I certainly did not become Rory Sutherland, but I got pretty close. I mean, John and I essentially traveled the world trying to spread the gospel of marketing effectiveness, trying to tell entertaining stories and anecdotes. So I'd say we were like D-list Rory Sutherland by the end. But yeah, I don't think it's, I wouldn't say it's the general path most people in the industry or the general experience.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about then. Let's talk about what you and John set up at LinkedIn then, because that wasn't something that happened, you know, immediately or overnight when you started at LinkedIn. What kind of inspired you to do that, to create that B2B Institute?
Yeah, I think if I were to break my career down into phases, the first phase was I worked in advertising and didn't really know anything about advertising.
Which puts you in the majority, probably.
Yeah, honestly, I think a lot of people are secretly in that situation. And it's because, going back to the original conversation, I never studied advertising. I had no formal education in advertising or marketing. I just kind of learned on the job, and a lot of the on-the-job training was not particularly good and not particularly accurate. So John and I were sort of like consultants, and we would go in, we were at LinkedIn, and we would go in and tell people, you know, how to increase their performance on LinkedIn, how to get higher click-through rates. And we thought we were pretty smart, but then one day we sort of realized we were actually pretty stupid. We didn't really know what we were talking about. We basically knew a lot of very tactical bullshit. Like, we knew how to increase your click-through rate, but we didn't know if click-through rates were even an important metric. And of course, it turns out they're not an important metric at all. It's a totally worthless sort of like vanity metric. So we knew the tactical stuff, but we didn't know the answers to the big questions, like, is click-through rate meaningful in the first place? What objectives are meaningful? How do brands grow? And that was our kind of first realization. And then our second realization was that nobody else really knew either. There was like a very small group of people in this marketing effectiveness community, like Les Bennett and Peter Field and Ritson and Ehrenberg Bass, who did seem to be taking a very empirical approach to understanding what works in marketing. But that had not really permeated the industry, and it certainly had not permeated B2B. B2B was just, you know, even in marketing effectiveness, is an ignored topic. If you read How Brands Grow, it's mostly B2C examples, like what works for Coca-Cola. Bennett and Fields, a lot of their work was all about B2C brands, like, you know, Whiskas and all these UK brands I don't even know. But that was the gap we saw. So we were like, we need to educate ourselves first and foremost. We need to learn, you know, what works in B2B marketing. What are the decisions that lead to better financial performance based not on random people's opinions or feelings, but based on some sort of hard quantitative data. And then we realized our clients, you know, be good for our clients too. We did this presentation. I want to say it was for like Cisco very early on. And it was not about LinkedIn. It was just about kind of ideas or contrarian ideas and approaches to B2B marketing. And it went really well. The client was like, oh, that was great. That was super interesting. It was not like a sales pitch. It was just sort of thought leadership, expertise, and expertise I haven't really heard before. So these things were kind of all swirling around in our brains where we were like, clients want expertise. There's really not a lot of expertise out there, especially in B2B. Maybe we could fill the gap in the industry and provide true B2B marketing expertise. And then it's a kind of winding road from there. But that was the sort of foundational insight that ultimately led to the creation of the B2B Institute at LinkedIn.
Yeah, and what was the most kind of pivotal moment when you realized that you were, you know, truly being heard?
The pivotal moment was, you know, our first report that put us on the map was I sent a LinkedIn message to Les Burnett, who has since become a mentor of mine, one of the godfathers of effectiveness, along with Peter Fields. And I was just like, hey, you know, you have this incredible concept, the long and the short of it, the 60-40 rule. Have you ever looked at this just for B2B brands? And Les very kindly responded, and he was like, no, you know, we have a bunch of B2B data in the IPA data bank. We just never bothered to even really look at it. And then John and I were like, cool, well, could we hire you to write the first B2B cut of the IPA data bank and mine, you know, this 40 years of econometrics to tell us what works in B2B, what is the right balance between brand and demand and different types of brand goals, et cetera. And he said, sure, I'd be happy to do that. So him and Peter did that, and we published our first report, which is the Principles of B2B Marketing. And it really made an impact. I mean, we launched it in London. There was a huge turnout. There was a lot of media coverage of it. It just sort of like, you know, immediately filled a gap where people had a feeling like brand was important in B2B, but they just didn't have a lot of proof. They didn't have a lot of empirical evidence. And we kind of provided that for the first time, or Les and Peter provided it for the first time. And, you know, like all brands, it took a long time to build up from there. I mean, there was not a single moment. It was like 5 years of very consistent marketing of the concepts and bringing in different experts like Aaron Berg Bass and Ritson and so on and so forth. But yeah, I think it was really that initial report from Les and Peter that kind of put it on the map.
Yeah. No, amazing. And what great work it was too. It's funny because I think that speaking as someone who's practiced what we call proper marketing for 15 years now in our little independent agency, there's been a frustration along that journey of thinking or maybe feeling like you are a contrarian versus the group think. But the frustration comes from realizing that the contrarian or so-called contrarian is actually the one who's probably right most of the time. And so actually you can either take there's either two decisions to make. One, you can just become increasingly cynical and frustrated. Or number two, which I took me too long to realize, is actually you can go about fixing the problem. And whether you do that via empirical data or just better communications with your clients, it is ultimately the only way out.
100%.
Yeah, well, hats off to you. Well done. It's funny. I need to articulate this in the way that it's intended, because it's intended with, you know, huge amounts of respect and praise. But there's things which I know you don't claim to have created, but certainly popularized, like the 95-5 rule. There'll be people who worked in the industry for decades preceding that who said, well, you know, that's always been true and always been known. But actually, there's a real marketing lesson there that actually badging something as a 95-5 rule and communicating it proved to be a lot more effective than whatever people were doing previously who claimed to have known that that was always the case, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, I'm not even sure any of our research was a totally original contribution, and that was never really our KPI, if you will. It was to try to market these ideas to the marketing industry and get them to be known and adopted. I mean, as we said at the start, like some of these concepts, like, oh, you've got to build a brand through entertaining creative and jingles. Some of this stuff has been known for 100 years. I mean, you could literally go back to like early IBM advertising and see this stuff happening in B2B. I think probably because of the invention of the internet. The internet era got everybody sort of forgetting everything we knew about marketing effectiveness. Everyone was like, okay, now it's all about real time response rates, click rates. It put us in a little bit of like an intellectual black hole. And so I actually think a lot of the research is just rediscovering things that were known in the past, but forgotten for the past 20 years. And yeah, I think part of the internet era was an obsession with data and evidence, which, you know, you could bemoan or you could say is good. People should look for proof that something works. And that is the massive gap that the Ehrenberg-Bass Institute and Bennett and Field and all these experts have really filled. They are not, you know, cooking up their opinions and thoughts about how marketing works. They are studying the data, seeing the decisions the marketers made, seeing what happens financially in those categories, and they're using that to back into theory. If you go back to history, this happens a lot in history where people will tinker around and discover something naturally, and then in some case decades later, sort of academics will be able to explain why that actually worked. And that's like tinker versus theory, a good mental model. And ultimately, I think you do need both. You need to tinker, and then you need theory that proves the tinkering wasn't just a fluke, a one-off. And that's how you ultimately get broad adoption of those ideas.
I knew that BA in history would come into play.
Yeah, I mean, here I was saying it was useless, and now I can't keep going back to history. You got me hooked.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, everything you've just said is true. And it's really nice to hear you talk about the fact that a lot of what has been shared, you know, was previously known, perhaps was lost, but ultimately needed to be communicated more effectively, ironically or appropriately, to the industry. I was going to, and I still might at some stage, talk to you about sci-fi, because I know you're a fan, hence one of our quickfire questions. One of the first ever guests we had on Call to Action, going back almost 6 years, was sadly no longer with us, the late, great Murray Calder. I'm not sure if your paths would ever have crossed, but Murray was a wonderful strategist. He did a lot of work for whiskey brands, including Macallan and various others. And he made a similar observation of the state, if that's not too harsh a word, of the industry. And he said, the trouble is, unlike in whiskey, where there is such a high cost barrier to entry, it's almost impossible to buy a shit whiskey because you have to invest so much into it. You don't really tend to get cowboys, was his point. We can probably argue about the subjectivity of what a shit whiskey is quite easily, and marketing would actually benefit from having a bit more of a cost to entry. And where I'm going with this is your point about the internet and everyone having access to data is a wonderful thing, but in many ways it also lowered that what was already a small barrier to entry to marketing, so that people in other departments could claim to be experts because they could understand the data that was coming from the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I was the beneficiary of this. So like I was, you know, 21 years old and clearly knew absolutely nothing about marketing. But people assumed because I was 21 years old, I knew a lot about social media, which at the time was sort of like the hot concept. And, you know, very senior people at marketing organizations were willing to listen to my opinions on what they should do about social media, despite me having no true understanding of how marketing works in the first place. Which was wonderful for me personally, but I don't think ultimately is a good thing for the marketing industry. You know, I think there are some bedrock principles people need to learn, like the importance of mental availability and physical availability and coming to mind in buying situations. I mean, there's a million sort of keystone concepts that then need to be carried through and applied to new technologies. But instead, everybody's just like, oh, who knows the new technologies? And they sort of look past any lack of real marketing credentials, which I think is a shame. I hate to say it. Time, weather, and
always. We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V. Sunshine. Here we go.
Given your success at LinkedIn, what made you take the leap and set up Evidenza?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to what led to us starting the B2B Institute, where we had a problem. John and I had our own personal problem, and then we saw a business opportunity. And the personal, I guess the professional problem. We have lots of personal problems too, but our professional problem.
We don't have time for all of them.
Yeah, we don't have time. I'm sure you don't want to go too long on that, but we could do a brief 3 hours on my personal problem. Now, my professional problem was this. John and I were helping clients implement Ehrenberg Bass style marketing. And the key input to do that was market research. So if you wanted to help Salesforce orient its advertising around category entry points and distinctive brand assets, which are two key Ehrenberg Bass concepts, you need to field research on category entry points and distinctive brand assets. So that means you need to design a survey. You need to field it to, in some cases, very, very senior and highly paid B2B audiences, like, you know, VPs of sales, CROs, CEOs, CIOs, and ask them a whole battery of questions about the brands and the categories in CRM. And what we found, and what many marketers find, is that it's just an agonizingly painful process, market research. It tends to be very, very slow. So, you know, we would have a meeting next week with a client, but the research wouldn't be ready for, in some cases, 6 months. And it was also super expensive. And, you know, we had a pretty generous research budget, a multi-million dollar research budget. But even that multi-million dollar research budget was not sufficient to really scale market research in any meaningful way because it was so expensive. We could only bring it to like our top five clients. And then we just had to kind of like make stuff up or think about how it could translate to the other 40,000 clients, right? And so just we were deeply frustrated by that. We knew that market research was the critical input in a marketing strategy, but we couldn't figure out a good way to do market research at scale. And then one day we sort of stumbled upon this solution where we were reading about AI. We were like, okay, so Silicon Valley has invented this magical robot that can pass all these professional licensing exams. It can pass the LSAT, the SAT, the GRE, you know, medical board exams. We were like, if this robot is so smart, can it pass marketing exams? Can AI take surveys and get you the same answers that you would have gotten from real people? And we sat down at lunch with my friend Brian, who I went to college with, who turned out to be a software engineer, not what he studied at college. Of course, he studied some useless humanities subject like myself. And we were like, hey, is that possible? You know, could AI take surveys and get you the same answers? And Brian kind of disappeared for a few months. And then he came back to us with a synthetic research report, maybe the world's first synthetic research report. So in other words, instead of asking real CRM buyers why they buy the category and, you know, which logos they recognized, he created a synthetic sample. So in other words, he got AI to imitate CRM buyers of different seniorities and different backgrounds and different industries, thousands of independently thinking, now you'd call it AI agents. And he got them to take a survey and he handed us the results. And I think we did what any sane person would do. We compared it to the actual results we had gotten from real people. And we found the results were basically identical. The synthetic data, the synthetic research, pretty much matched, you know, to the T what we were seeing from real CRM buyers. And, you know, that could have been a fluke. So then we looked at it for a few different categories like business banking, infrastructure as a service, business analytics. And every time we just found this kind of shocking similarity rate between AI generated responses and human responses. And then we said to ourselves, okay, well, now you've got a real business problem, a serious business problem, which is that companies need the voice of the customer, but the customer is not always easy to find. It's not always easy to get them to take a 50-question survey. And this is a new technology just developed that could solve this problem, and nobody's really onto it yet. You know, everybody even sort of still is talking about AI can write copy. That's like as far as the industry has gotten it. We were like, yeah, I actually can do this other activity, which is a lot more painful and in some cases more important than writing copy. And we subsequently quit our jobs in January of 2024, started Evidenza. And here we are now, living the dream in Brooklyn, 10 months later.
Amazing. We had Mimi Turner on a few weeks ago talking about hidden buyers in B2B. Are your synth models finding these hidden buyers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that research, which is great, is talking about the buying committee. And that's another thing that's actually really hard to do in B2B is model the buying committee. And that's a lot of the work we've been doing with synthetic research is saying, who are the 20 to 30 people who actually weigh in on the purchase of a new cloud computing solution? And then, of course, getting all of their perspectives. Again, very hard to do with traditional research because, you know, there are all kinds of different professionals. Some have higher, lower incidence rates than others. All of them, again, tend to be very busy, very well paid. So what you can do with synthetic research is model the entire buying committee, build AI-generated copies of every member of the buying committee, and then essentially survey them to get the diverse perspectives of different members of the buying committee. So I think AI helps you take that insight that there are all these different sort of people, some of whom are not always obvious, weighing in on B2B purchases and truly understand their perspectives and their needs.
And how would you go about validating the results from a buyer that is, you know, famously either hidden or difficult to find?
Yeah, well, we really do validation in two ways. One of the main ways we do validation is we do demos of our platform, the Evidenza platform, and we will show clients in that demo an enormous amount of data on their category and their audience. So we'll say, okay, you sell inertial navigation systems to mining operators in Australia. Here is a synthetic sample of mining operators in Australia. We'll have live qualitative interviews with them on the demo. We'll field a survey to them on the demo to understand their category entry points, perceptions of different brands. And marketers generally know their own brands and categories well enough that they can sort of submit it to a sniff test. They can say, that looks right. That's something we hear from our customers all the time. That matches previous research we've done. And then they say, okay, great. You know, this looks to really track with what we know to be true. Let's start testing this and applying it. And I'd say that's actually most of the validation we do. Then there's a group of people who are like, the demo looks great, but, you know, I need some additional validation. So the story we like to tell is about the CMO of EY Americas. So this woman, Toni Clayton Hines, super talented CMO of one of the great B2B brands in the world, EY, formerly Ernst & Young. And actually, we went to her in, I want to say, February and gave her our pitch. Like, hey, you've got this new technology, synthetic research. You can survey CEOs, get the same answers much faster, much more cost efficiently. And Toni listened to us very patiently, the kind of mix of amazement and skepticism. She was like, listen, if this is what you say it is, it would be a very big deal. It would kind of change how we think about marketing and how we go to market. But it's a very bold claim. So you're going to need to kind of prove to me that it is what you say it is. So Toni structured a test. What she did is every year she runs a survey of CEOs of companies with $10 billion in revenue in the United States. And she gave us not the answers to her survey. Actually, she hadn't even gotten those answers back. She just gave us the questionnaire. So who are the people in the sample? What did we ask them? And then Brian got to work building a synthetic sample of CEOs of companies with $10 billion in revenue. He got them to take the survey, and we submitted our answers to Toni. And then Toni did, again, sort of what we had done when we started the company. She looked at the results side by side. How similar were the synthetic responses to the ones she had gotten from real CEOs? And in the end, we reached 95% of the same conclusions as her actual survey. And, you know, again, could that be a fluke? Yes, but we have done that like 60 to 70 times now in many different categories, in many different markets, to sort of build our own confidence and our customers' confidence that you really are getting an accurate simulation of what you are likely to hear from clients. So really, I think there's two ways to validate. There is seeing it for yourself and how well it tracks what you know about the category. And then there is a sort of more empirical, structured way to do it, which is to run a head-to-head test and see the responses you get from synthetic customers versus human customers.
I suppose many people probably respond to Evidenza and what you're doing in the same way they might respond to, they shouldn't do this, by the way, to a marketing agency using ChatGPT for copywriting purposes, right? And I think the reactions I've seen on things like that range from everything at the bottom to why should I bother to read something that nobody was bothered to write, all the way up to more kind of complex takes on the use of AI. And so I don't think you should perceive that to be, you know, a negative take on what you're doing, because I think what you're doing is groundbreaking and fascinating and wonderful. We have a listener question, which I'm actually going to do slightly early just to show my hand. He's a key client of ours at GARS, Brian McCready. He also spoke at Festival of Marketing. His team won Marketing Team of the Year last year.
Congratulations, Brian.
He's a brilliant marketer. I also know he's a big fan of yours too, but he's actually asked a question about that EY example. Just focusing on the use of synthetic data for thought leadership creation, the EY example that Ritson has shared recently showing that synthetic data can replicate or predict real research data to a reasonably high level of accuracy was eye-catching. But do we only know the synthetic data was accurate because we could compare it with actual fresh client feedback? And moreover, isn't the EY research data more powerful and trusted because it's from EY and from actual C-suite interviews? Trust is critical in B2B purchasing, so isn't the joint power of brand and of actual verifiable human responses still the trump card?
Yeah, I think there are limitations to what synthetic research can do. And we always try to be very upfront about what those are. Ultimately, you're going to see clients use it in all kinds of different ways. In some cases, it can wholesale replace some very slow and expensive forms of research. Segmentation being one of them. We do a lot of that kind of work. Category entry point analysis, creative testing. In other cases, you may take a more hybrid approach. Like one limitation of synthetic research is that it doesn't have a great sense of change over time, at least right now. So, I mean, it could tell you in the EY case, like what your consideration is in a certain market and among a certain audience or sector with a very high degree of accuracy. But it can't necessarily tell you how that's changing month over month. For that, you still need some traditional sort of brand tracking. So that would be a hybrid approach where maybe you use synthetic research to establish a benchmark or a baseline, then you use traditional research to establish change over time. There's other combinations. You know, we have clients who will do qual with real humans, and then they will do quant synthetically, or vice versa. They've got a traditional quant, and they want some synthetic qual to sort of go deeper on the insights and understand why people said what they said. There's data cuts. So we have clients who are like, I ran a huge survey of, you know, many, many different types of buyers in EMEA, but of course the samples were too small to cut it by market or by industry. They'll have a traditional survey and then they'll do synthetic data cuts. So all of that is to say, you know, people are going to be at different stages of the skepticism journey. Some are not skeptical, some are lightly skeptical, but can be convinced. I think that's where, you know, Tony was and where a lot of CMOs are going to be. Then you have people who are just like, absolutely not. This is a totally ridiculous concept. I want nothing to do with it. Those people, you know, maybe they'll come around in 5 years. Maybe they'll never come around. But there's different ways to play around with it. I mean, we have clients who are sort of going all in on synthetic research and using it to fuel all kinds of marketing decisions. We have clients who are using it as one of multiple tools in the toolbox. And, you know, I think you have to think about what your own level of skepticism is and what your organization is like and where they're at in the adoption curve of AI, which is just all over the place, depending on the culture of the company. I admire the skepticism, you know? There's a famous quote, it's from someone very famous, although incredibly I can't remember it. Maybe it's Carl Sagan. He's like, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, you know? So this is an extraordinary claim. I think it's great that people are skeptical. The very cynical part of me finds it, I don't want to say annoying, but maybe strange that, like, we haven't had that skepticism over the past 20 years towards many other forms of technology that I think were a lot less revolutionary and transformative than AI. You know, like, you've got all these programmatic vendors being like, oh, we can reach, you know, CEOs with 100% precision on a bunch of random sites. We're not going to tell you what they are. And people were like, oh, great, we're going to funnel billions of dollars into that entire ecosystem with very little skepticism. So I admire the skepticism. I think it's kind of funny that, like, for once we actually have a totally paradigm shifting revolutionary technology. And now all of a sudden is everyone skeptical, but, you know, better late than never. And I think it's a good thing. I welcome it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What was that famous claim with that? I can't remember what it was now. Something along the lines of we can reach more Swedish teenagers than it turned out even existed.
Yeah, I mean that happened to me all the time. Yeah. I had a client who was like, I'm trying to reach IT decision makers in Australia, and I'm using programmatic to do it. And I'd be like, cool. Ask them how many IT decision makers they can reach in Australia, and they were like, okay. We went back. We asked the vendor. You know, the answer is 90 million. I'm like, cool. I think that's like many orders of magnitude larger than the entire population of Australia. So maybe there's something like a little, that would be a good place to apply skepticism.
On using AI for marketing effectiveness, John has said, everyone is going to get better. Average is over. How do you see AI and advertising effectiveness working together? Where does the battle move to? Because clearly average can't be over, but I wonder what average will look like post AI.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time to be alive. John and I feel that we are sort of at the center of two revolutions right now, all of us in the marketing industry. There is the AI revolution, which is coming at us very fast. And then there is this marketing effectiveness revolution, which is coming at us very slow. You know, AI has been adopted very rapidly. I think ChatGPT is probably like one of the fastest growing consumer apps of all time. I think it was 2 months to get to 100 million users. Took Spotify like 10 years to do that, right? So super fast growing. And then a lot of this marketing effectiveness research, like how brands grow, from Professor Byron Sharp, I mean, it was published, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago or something like that. And still most people haven't read the book. So you've got these two revolutions happening, a kind of slow motion one and a fast motion one. AI in our mind is fundamentally an efficiency revolution. So whatever you're doing, you're going to be able to do it a lot faster, a lot more cost effectively with AI. Marketing effectiveness, it's an effectiveness revolution, right? It's rethinking what you should be doing in the first place. And I think where you're going to find is that the best marketers, the ones who really gain an edge, are going to be able to balance both of those revolutions in their head. So in other words, let's say you give a improperly trained marketer access to synthetic research. Yes, they're going to get answers to their questions faster and more cost effectively than they could before. And listen, that's a win. You know, it makes things more efficient. But they might ask the wrong questions. You know, they're going to ask questions. We had this recently where a client was like, I want to ask what my brand awareness is. This was a big brand. And the answer came back and it was like 95% or something like that. And they were like, well, that's not very insightful. And I was like, I totally agree with you. It's not very insightful, but that's because it's not a great question. You know, the question, once you're a brand of a certain size, brand awareness stops being a super useful metric. What you actually need to measure is mental availability, which is a marketing effectiveness concept, which is, okay, there's 30 different buying situations that trigger a purchase in, you know, commercial insurance. And here's how easily you come to mind in each of those 30 buying situations relative to the competition. Here's where you're strong and weak. So John and I go back to this Picasso quote, an early AI theorist. He said, the problem with computers is they can only give you answers. In other words, you know, the job of a human and human intellect is to ask the right questions. And so I think what you're going to find is, you know, average marketers are going to ask average questions and get average answers. And above average marketers who really understand the fundamentals of how brands grow, who know what questions to ask in the first place, are going to get a lot more effectiveness out of AI, not just more efficiency. So that's sort of how I see the market ultimately breaking down. You'll get people who just get efficiency, and then you'll see people who get efficiency and effectiveness. And the biggest returns are going to go to the latter group, not the former.
Yeah, makes sense. We have had Andrew Jolliffe on, and given, I think I can safely assume from your comments on Rory earlier, you like eccentric marketers. I would strongly recommend, if you find yourself with a spare hour, to listen to the episode. But I do remember Andrew. He's honestly one of the most fascinating careers you'll ever hear. He's won everything from BAFTAs to Cannes Lion to all sorts, but he's an incredibly interesting man. A point he made on the internet, and I think he was aiming it towards the frustration of how we overly rely on it from a creative kind of advertising perspective, was that he said the internet's like a vending machine. It gives you what you ask for, and there's no sense of discovery. You don't kind of stumble upon things like you might do prior to the internet. So there's a similarity there to the Picasso quote, the second coming perhaps. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to move to listener questions, because as I mentioned to you pre-recording, we do have a few to try and squeeze in.
Please.
Asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger, but that's not stopped us asking. So I've got a question here from Matthew Hall. Matthew asks, we've heard about the accuracy and overall capabilities of Evidenza from a diagnostic perspective. Do you have any clients who have used AI to advise not only their diagnostic efforts, but also their strategic and tactical efforts?
Yes, that is a great question. You know, we actually see it fundamentally as a strategic planning tool. I mean, this is sort of the power of AI is, yes, you can use it to build a synthetic sample and get, you know, synthetic data and answers back. But you can also ask AI to arrange all of that into a marketing plan. So ultimately, most of the work we do with clients is not purely diagnostic. It is helping them build out a marketing plan or a marketing strategy. And as we learned from Professor Ritson, proud alumni of his mini MBA program, you know, a marketing strategy really has these three key components. You need to know who to target, how to position the brand, and what sort of commercial objectives to set. And that is actually a lot of the work we're doing. So with targeting, we'll build a synthetic sample. We'll field essentially a segmentation survey to them. And we'll try to understand who are the different types of buyers in the market. You know, which ones have the most commercial upside? So we'll append secondary financial data to those segments to say, hey, it's these, you know, IT directors in financial services. It's not, you know, these ones in pharmaceuticals that have the most commercial upside for you. So that's who you should target. So that's using synthetic data to make a strategic decision about we're going to go after, we're going to address this segment and not that segment. And that's targeting. Then we go into positioning, where we will field a category entry point survey to a synthetic sample and say, here are all the buying situations in your category. Here's why people buy airline maintenance services. And here's the situations that make the most sense for you. You as a brand have the most pre-existing credibility in these buying situations. It's not already strongly associated with a competitor. You know, here you go. These are the three situations or category entry points that you should be going after. Here is the commercial upside. So here's the financial value of each category entry point. If you increase your mind share 1% in this situation, here is the potential commercial return. So that's positioning. So now you know what segment am I going to target and which situations or buying situations am I going to position the brand against? And then you've even started to get objectives there of our commercial objective is to increase our mental availability 1% in the, you know, drinking beer at home with my friends buying situation. And here is the expected commercial return. So that is not diagnosis, that's strategy. Strategy, of course, is fueled by diagnosis. I think where we end, where Evidenza ends, is we don't really see it as a tactical execution tool. I think there are already a lot of those, and there will be more and more every day. We kind of see it as, you know, we will work with clients to write the brief using synthetic research and synthetic strategy. So we'll say, you're going to go after this target, you're going to take this position, you're going to set these objectives. All of that goes into a brief that you then hand to, you know, a creative agency, or in some cases, you know, another AI program that can actually generate creative. And then, of course, you have to run all of that. And there's places where we can play in the tactical space, like we can test creative against a synthetic sample. We can recommend media channels that the synthetic sample says they consume. So it can play in that space. But to me, the big opportunity is in diagnosis and strategy and less so in tactics. I think the marketing industry has been overly focused on the tactical applications of AI, which are real, but, you know, we tend to be pretty good at tactics. I think where we invest less time and money and resources is in actually building the right strategies. And AI has a role to play there too.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. I think the link between diagnosis and strategy is the bit that strangely often seems broken, when of course it shouldn't, because one is meant to lead to the other. But certainly in my experience,
yeah, I mean, you could make a lot of criticisms of diagnosis or market research. Like, sure, there's the slowness and the cost are the obvious ones. But the truth is, I think for a lot of marketers, you get back like 900 slides of data. And you're like, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, I'm not in this for research's sake. I need to make a decision. You know, I need to make a choice, which is strategy. So we have really tried to combine the two, where We're actually trying to build the strategy, and then we're using diagnosis to fill in the strategy, and they are integrated in that way versus we get a 900-slide presentation, we put it in a drawer and ignore it, and then we go build our strategy, or we skip strategy altogether and go to tactics, which I'm sad to say I think happens a lot in the marketing industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly does. A couple of questions here from someone who, well, a research agency who wishes to remain anonymous, not for any malicious reasons, I'm sure. Will we eventually reach a point where AI-generated content on the internet drowns out the human-generated content? And what will that mean for synthetic data?
Yeah, I think this is probably the funniest sort of panic in the marketing industry right now, is everyone's like, oh, we're going to be awash in AI-generated creative, and it's going to be terrible. As I like to joke, we're actually already awash in absolutely horrible content and creative. It's just produced by humans at enormous expense and cost. Probably the least popular research I ever did in my life was with System One, where we looked at thousands of B2B ads. We scored them on a 1 to 5 scale of effectiveness, 5 being very effective, 1 being totally ineffective. And I want to say something like 75% of ads scored a 1 on a 1 to 5 scale. So the truth is, like, we're already living in that dystopia. I don't view it as like, is AI going to make it worse? You know, maybe it's just because I'm a plucky optimist, but I think it has the potential in some cases to make it better. You know, people will actually do diagnosis to inform their creative, which people often don't do today because it is so slow and expensive. Creative, I mean, what's starting to happen is that Ritson has this idea of brand codes. That's his version of distinctive brand assets. So understanding, you know, the logos and colors and jingles and mascots that evoke the brand without naming the brand. And I think what you'll find with AI is that AI can identify what those assets are. And then you can actually brief, you know, you can use a platform like DALL-E. In our case, like, our distinctive branding is futuristic Italian Renaissance. That's our brief. And now we have images all throughout our platform and our presentations that are futuristic Italian Renaissance generated by AI. And everything is on brief and perfectly branded because we used AI to both build the distinctive brand assets and to then execute against those distinctive brand assets. So I think there's a chance you're going to get actually better, at least better branded creative. And, you know, will it be as fun and funny and creative? Maybe jury's still out on that, but most advertising today is not particularly fun or creative or effective. So, you know, that's a mix of extreme cynicism and extreme optimism for you. I'm not exactly sure how people will take it, but it's how I feel.
Yeah. And it's not just content, right? I mean, depending on whether you believe, I don't know, Dr. Wu's analytics or, you know, the brilliant Bob Hoffman's rants and blogs, most traffic on the internet isn't even human these days anyway. So what does it matter?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this is a really funny thing where people are like, oh my God, you're getting robots to take surveys. I'm like, actually, that's already starting to happen. So I think a lot of these research companies are realizing that people taking their surveys in many cases are robots in the first place. They just happen to think they're people, whereas we are intentionally, you know, programming machines to take our surveys. So a lot of things are synthetic, whether you know they're synthetic or not. And it doesn't always need to be a bad thing, you know? I mean, we actually debated when we started the company, is synthetic a bad word? Is it like pejorative? But you can actually look at these different, go back to history where we started. Sometimes synthetic things are actually a huge improvement. Like, you used to have human, or not even human, but earth-made diamonds. Now you have synthetic diamonds, which are, you know, better for the environment. You've got synthetic fuels. You've got synthetic rubber. And you've got all these kinds of inventions where humans are able to sort of manufacture things instead of the previous processes, which in many cases were worse or more destructive. So again, that's sort of how I think about the opportunity here. Things could be a lot better, actually.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I'm going to quickly squeeze in one more because I think it might appeal to the sci-fi fan in you, albeit it is slightly dystopian, which is, do you think everyone should have access to a synthetic version of their own child to help them better parent?
Wow. I don't even know how to think about that one. Here is what I will tell you, because it's very science fiction. Have you ever read Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson?
No, I haven't.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible science fiction book. And basically every kid in this novel, it's a future sci-fi novel, is given like, it's kind of like an iPad with an AI in it who gives them a very personal education based on everything else going on in their lives. And I do think John and I both actually use ChatGPT a lot with our children. We don't have children together. We have separate children. So like my son will be like, hey, I want to know about cars. And I will open up ChatGPT and he'll say, hey, tell me about cars. And I'll add the context that it's a 2.5-year-old. And ChatGPT will tell him about cars. And then he'll say, hey, could you draw me a picture of dinosaurs taking a double-decker bus in London? And it will generate that image for him. So I actually think it's kind of incredible. And going back to the point about the existing education system, which is like a manufacturing model, or it's like that's literally what it's born out of, like manufacturing days of you put everyone in a classroom and you teach them the exact same thing and they all progress at the same speed. I think the opportunity to have this sort of like hyper personalized education with AI is great. Would I create a synthetic copy of my child? Probably not. But listen, there are all kinds of weird use cases. Like we have people come to us, they're like, hey, could you create a synthetic jury? And then could I practice my closing arguments on a synthetic jury? You know, could you create a synthetic financial analyst community and have me practice 10 versions of my earnings call on that audience? So listen, there's going to be all kinds of very strange, maybe even dystopian applications of it. But we're focused on the non-dystopian application, which is building marketing strategies, which I would say is relatively benign. And when somebody comes and creates the synthetic child company, you know, I'm not sure I myself will be a customer of that, but perhaps there's a market for it. Who can say?
I mean, who really knows what John is doing right now?
Yeah, for all I know, John's downstairs cooking up a synthetic child audience platform, but I doubt it.
Nice. Brilliant. I'm going to try and wrap the last four pertinent poses up quickly because I'm mindful of stealing too much of your time, Peter. But number one is, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I wouldn't give any advice to my younger self. First of all, I'm happy. I'm happy with how things ended, or I don't know if my life is over, but I'm happy where I am right now. I wouldn't want to interfere. More importantly, I'm pretty sure my younger self would tell my older self to fuck off and not listen to anything I have to say. It might even hate me, actually. Younger Peter would almost certainly hate older Peter. So I wouldn't waste either of our time giving advice to my younger self.
Amazing. Two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
Everyone's got their kind of like bugbear of thing they hate, you know, for Ritson is brand purpose. For me, it's personalization. I think marketing personalization is like a really bad idea. I think it's based on a fundamental misunderstanding of how marketing works. Like marketing is not about understanding each individual and designing messaging for that specific individual. It's about understanding what large groups of people have in common and then speaking to their common needs at scale. So, you know, personalization, it was super hot a few years ago. I think it continues to be hot, but it's cooled a little bit. And I do think behind that tactical idea is a deep misunderstanding of what drives marketing effectiveness. So if I could banish a concept from the discourse, it would probably be this idea of one-to-one marketing personalization.
Love it. I don't think that's come up before, which is mind-blowing, really, because I feel similar way. There's that kind of wonderful signaling power you get with a broad mass communication, and it seems strange that you have to kind of remind people that a one-to-one conversation, which is the equivalent of someone, I don't know, dragging you into an alleyway and trying to sell you something.
Yeah, exactly. It's just common sense. It's like, have you ever read a great personalized book or song? You know, these things are not creative. The best creative is not personalized. It's impersonalized, or it's based on some universal insight, like kids like movies about creatures that are lost and need to find their way home. And that very simple, generalizable insight has led to everything from Bambi to Finding Nemo, right? So this idea that, you know, creative needs to be specific to an individual is just like very odd, very ahistorical, and I would say quite destructive as a concept.
Agreed. Number three, apart from Diamond Age, which I'll link to in the show's listing, are there any books that you can recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two most important marketing books to read that will basically teach you everything you need to know about marketing are, of course, How Brands Grow by Professor Byron Sharp, Building Distinctive Brand Assets by Jenny Romaniuk, and then How Not to Plan by Les Bennett and Sarah Carter. if you read those three books, I think you'll know everything there is to know about marketing effectiveness, and it'll give you a great idea of what to ask AI to do. And then there's some kind of non-marketing books that have been super influential in our thinking. You know, two I would call out specifically are this book Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb, which is just filled with amazing mental models that are very applicable to marketing. Like, you know, old ideas are old for a reason because they've survived all kinds of disruption. I think that's an important concept to help people understand why they need to stick with their old creative. And then there's a killer book called The Elephant in the Brain, which is kind of a Rory Sutherland-esque book about behavior and human psychology. He covers a lot of these concepts we've even discussed today, like you mentioned signaling and those types of concepts. So those are two non-marketing books and three marketing books that I think have hugely shaped how we see the world. And I really could not possibly recommend highly enough.
Amazing. Well, we'll link to all of those books. And then lastly, we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow that honor to our guest who has to give their reason why. Would you do the honors of dedicating this episode?
Of course. I mean, I think my mind always jumps to my teachers, the teachers I had. Obviously, there's the teachers I had later in my career, like Ritson and Bennett and Jenny Romaniak. But I think very early in my career, like when I was in middle school, I think of my history teacher, Miss Sperling, who I think taught me the bedrocks of history, ancient Greece and ancient Rome and ancient India. And I would say just gave me a love of learning that I think is essential and has served me well in life. So teachers generally very underappreciated in society. Critical role to play for all and for myself. So I guess I would dedicate it to Miss Sperling. I'm not sure where she is now, but I hope she's well. She's probably not listening to a lot of marketing podcasts, but who knows where life has taken her. Maybe she's a hardcore B2B marketer and she'll be pleasantly surprised to hear this.
Yeah. Well, I truly hope so. But either way, this episode is very happily dedicated to Miss Sperling. Fantastic. So everyone listening, as our final call to action, head over to this episode online, wherever you get your podcast. We've shared links to everything discussed. So those six books, everything else we've discussed, I'll throw in Rory's TED Talk that we mentioned early on. How else can our listeners get more Peter Weinberg?
Yeah, well, you're welcome to visit our futuristic Italian Renaissance website, evidenza.ai. And then John and I post a steady stream of obnoxious contrarian opinions on LinkedIn, our beloved alma mater. So feel free to reach out on LinkedIn, follow us on LinkedIn, or visit our Research Renaissance website.
Perfect. Well, we'll link to that website and encourage people to do just that. So listen, thank you so much for joining us, Peter. I've enjoyed this immensely.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great conversation.
And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review our podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. I can't get no call to action. Oh, I can't get no call to action. Yeah, hey, hey.